This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 24th of October, 2015, on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Daniel Giacopelli, and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs broadcasted right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House, and The Monocle Daily. Coming up, NATO organizes its largest military exercise in over a decade. We'll discuss why. Then, we'll have Monocle's guide to the three things new Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau should focus on. We'll also ask if lyrics are really necessary in a national anthem. And we'll hear the best and the greatest from what's been happening at this year's Big Defense Exhibition in Seoul. All that and much more coming up in the next half hour, right here on The Recap, with me, Daniel Giacopelli. We start today with a highlight from Monday's edition of Midori House, where Andrew Muller was joined by journalist and commentator Jeffrey Kaufman and author and historian James Boyes. On Monday, NATO launched Trident Juncture, the alliance's largest exercise in more than a decade, involving 40,000 troops deployed over the next 5 weeks to theoretical engagements in various locations across Europe and the Med. NATO Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, American General Philip Breedlove, said the maneuvers send a very clear message to any potential aggressor, which was not believed to be a coded warning to Peru. Well, Andrew started the discussion by asking about the reasons behind the decision to organize the exercise now.
What we need to do, I think, is look at the historical context for this. Back in the 1980s, there was a NATO war operation called Able Archer, which many people in then the Soviet Union believe was actually a precursor for pre-strike capacity by the United States and NATO upon the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union, which almost led to a nuclear confrontation, which is one of the sort of untold stories of the Cold War. So when these operations are put into place now, I think there's a greater degree of advance warning effectively with Russia to make sure that doesn't happen. But there's no doubt about that anything like this is going to be seen as a provocative act by Russia, just as it would be seen if it was being initiated by them effectively at this time. So the way in which we look at this, it's all well and good, but clearly is potentially going to ratchet up the odds and the stakes with regard to the current situation between the West and the East.
I, for one, was tickled by one training scenario that this exercise will involve, Jeffrey, which I'll put to you, which sees a United Nations Security Council resolution authorizing NATO action to protect a threatened state.
Right.
Which the punchline is inbuilt there, obviously that Russia would not veto this. The question being, does NATO realistically have a potential adversary that isn't Russia?
It's an interesting question. I mean, China's pretty far away to be a NATO adversary. And so I think NATO's adversaries are actually, Russia aside, are ISIS and the militants of the Middle East and the chaos that's descending on all the countries of the once celebrated Arab Spring. I think those are a bigger threat and frankly a more existential threat than Russia, although Russia has to be addressed and contained. I think with Putin, you're seeing this kind of assertiveness that knows there's a line. And that's why, listen, it's no accident he invaded Ukraine and not Eastern Europe, because Ukraine is strategically, it's not part of NATO. And it's not, as much as Western leaders bemoaned what was happening, they weren't going to do anything about it.
Monocle's Andrew Muller there with journalist and commentator Jeffrey Kaufman and author and historian James Boyes. That was on Monday's edition of Midori House. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. China's President Xi Jinping started a three-day state visit to the UK on Tuesday, the first by a Chinese head of state in a decade. The economy was at the heart of the discussions, coming just a week after UK Chancellor George Osborne visited China, and with Chinese markets growing at their weakest rate this third quarter since the global financial crisis. But what of China's human rights record? When Xi's predecessor, Hu Jintao, visited in 2005, he was met with protests and unrest. Well, has anything changed? On Tuesday's edition of The Globalist, Georgina Godwin spoke with Isabel Hilton, journalist and CEO of China Dialogue.
Mr. Osborne wants investment. He has a lot of infrastructure needs to finance. He doesn't want to borrow because he has his own economic doctrine, which he seeks to limit government borrowing. So he's looking for external investment, and China has a lot of surplus cash, which is no longer getting a good return in China, and is looking for somewhere safe. So in that sense, it's a perfect marriage. There's also, you know, a certain resonance with Xi Jinping's approach. The Chinese Communist Party has basically said to the Chinese people, we'll make you more prosperous for the last 30 years if you stay out of politics. And it's not hard to see a parallel between Mr. Osborne's approach to China, which is to depoliticize it entirely in favor of economic judgments, and that of Xi Jinping. So both are sitting on top of a relatively fragile story, but they have common interests.
It is relatively fragile, as you say, and I'm wondering how risky that any kind of trade agreement is, given that China's stock market fell by almost 40% recently.
Xi Jinping started off with great promises of market reform. The Chinese economy was going to be allow the market to play a full role. However, what we've seen in the last couple of years is a rowing back from that. And the stock market was a very difficult lesson for Xi Jinping in the fact that you can't control the market. Actually, if you're going to put the market in charge, you have to put the market in charge. So people who were hoping for a fuller move to the market in the Chinese economy have been disappointed. And the regime is looking at the risks of the middle income trap. It's looking at all those problems that Asian tigers before them have faced, only on a much larger scale. And that is, how do you move from cheap manufacturing and too much investment to a much more sophisticated economy, moving up the value chain and all those things? Mm.
There's also this outcry about China and the nuclear deal on the cards.
Yes, well, the British, I think, are fairly open-minded about who does what in Britain. They've had to be. This is a very open economy. And in fact, large sectors of it are owned abroad, and people seem to live with that. There are, though, particular sensitive sectors, and I think that the residential housing market, which has driven house prices, you know, beyond the reach of ordinary Londoners, is one sensitivity. The notion of allowing the Chinese state to design, build and operate a nuclear plant is quite another level of seriousness. And we've seen not just the British people, but the British intelligence services raise quite serious concerns about allowing the Chinese Communist Party, in effect, to have a stake in Britain's critical infrastructure, and the kind of leverage that that gives the Chinese over British policy in other respects. You're taking, if you allow that to happen, you're taking a massive bet that there will be no serious issue between Britain and China for 50 years. I really don't think that's a safe bet.
That was a highlight from Tuesday's edition of The Globalist. Monocle's Georgina Godwin there with Isabel Hilton, journalist and CEO of China Dialogue. Let's continue now with a discussion on Canada's recent election result. On Tuesday, Canada was waking up to both seismic political change and a feeling of familiarity. The thumping victory by the Liberal Party in the country's general election had ended nearly a decade of conservative rule, but restored the House of Trudeau to 24 Sussex Drive. Canada's new prime minister is Justin Trudeau, 43-year-old son of the late Pierre Trudeau, who dominated Canadian politics throughout the 70s and 80s. This is what Monocle's Andrew Muller discussed with the Canadian journalist and commentator Jeffrey Kaufman.
The sentiment in Canada against Stephen Harper, who has been prime minister for, what, nine, almost 10 years, is so visceral, so venomous. He is such a divisive character, except for that rump of conservatives who will always vote conservative. It was really an anybody but Harper. Heave Steve was the campaign. And once it was clear that the New Democratic Party, the other opposition party, was collapsing, voters flocked to the Liberals because it was very clear they wanted to get rid of Harper. And boy, did they do it. This is seismic.
Is this just a reaction against Harper, though? I mean, it's vaguely evocative, or it sounds vaguely evocative, of the United Kingdom in 1997, when Tony Blair's Labour was carried into power on the back of just an electorate which was just bored and annoyed beyond belief with the Conservative Party.
Well, I remember from my studies in political science, it's true that elections are often lost, not won. But I think you've got to give Justin Trudeau more credit than that. This was really a study of contrast. Stephen Harper going for a fourth term, a man who had an agenda that started to really, really rub Canadians the wrong way. This is a man who was so controlling, so centralizing, and so suffocating in the way he imposed his agenda. I mean, this is a guy, for example, who would not meet with the premiers of the provinces, the first ministers. Traditionally, for generations, there have been annual meetings. He didn't want to meet with them. He didn't meet with the premier of Ontario, the largest province, a third of the population, for over a year because he didn't like her. He canceled the census. I mean, this is an incredibly negative force. And he used hatred or racism towards Muslims as a divisive wedge issue in this election. Justin Trudeau ran an incredibly positive campaign. It was all about the possibility of a better Canada. People bought it.
You talk about giving Trudeau credit, and indeed one should, because it is an incredible comeback by the Liberals. They had 36 seats in 2011. They probably have 184 now. What is it that voters see in Justin Trudeau other than a reassuringly familiar surname and nice hair?
So he is. I mean, listen, this is manifest destiny. There's no question. This is the son of, you know, when I was a kid, Pierre Trudeau allowed Canadians to dream big. Pierre Trudeau very much shaped my worldview as a man that the world recognized. I mean, he was one of very few leaders in Canada that the world knew. And he, a deep intellectual, deeply arrogant, a man who would not be tolerated in today's age, but he was prime minister for, 14 years. And he really shaped the Canada of today, bilingual, bicultural, or multicultural. And his son, Justin, is not the same man. He's young. He's, 43? He's a school teacher. He's been a politician for since, 2008? He is a bit of a blank slate. I mean, I think there is a bit of a risk with all of the hope and all of the opportunity that we see today that he's going to disappoint. But Canadians seem willing to gamble on that to get rid of Harper. This is a guy who really wants to take Canada back to the Liberal center, away from the far right.
Jeffrey Kaufman there, speaking with Monocle's Andrew Muller. Up next, we stick to the theme of Canadian election results and continue with a guide to the three areas that should catch the attention of the new PM.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows hosted right here on Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Giacopelli. The new Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau hasn't wasted any time. "We're back," was his message straight after the election results were announced. The Liberal Party leader says his country has now reclaimed its Liberal identity. The Liberal platform, Justin Trudeau told supporters, was a positive one. But the first challenge the new PM will face is transforming that electoral optimism into an agenda for government. On Tuesday's edition of The Globalist, Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis compiled a guide to three areas that should catch the attention of the new PM.
Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways.
The red wave, as it's being described, that swept across large parts of Canada on Monday evening is a remarkable turnaround for a party and a leader who managed to marshal the desire for change in federal politics here and turn it into votes. Here then are the three areas Prime Minister-elect Justin Trudeau will need to capitalise on if the concerns over his relative inexperience at the top of politics and some of the more contested policy platforms he ran his election campaign on are to be allayed.
We defeated the idea that Canadians should be satisfied with less, that good enough is good enough, and that better just isn't possible. Well, my friends, this is Canada, and in Canada, better is always possible. Thank you.
Number one, the economy. Justin Trudeau's vow to run a budget deficit over the opening years of a Liberal government was, at the outset, a gamble. His opponents, the Conservatives and the New Democrats, both vowed to balance the budget, which, at a time of economic uncertainty in the country, seemed to many the sensible choice. But it's Trudeau's message of borrowing to spend that chimed with voters. Prime Minister Trudeau must approach this carefully. Canada is in a fragile state economically and by some estimates is officially in recession. But there are bright spots in manufacturing in particular, with an increasing demand for products made in Canada. Justin Trudeau should seize on this and allow the private sector to grow if he has to stick to his guns and increase public spending on infrastructure elsewhere in the country. Number two, foreign affairs. There's no doubt that former Prime Minister Stephen Harper had a distinct vision for Canada on the world stage. A more visible, some say aggressive, military policy coupled with a harder line in support of Canada's interests abroad. No bad thing, you might say, but those policies have alienated those whom Canada once counted as friends. Justin Trudeau must rekindle relationships. Smoothing things over with Washington, D.C. should be a first step. But Trudeau should promote a Canada that's an active, positive participant in world affairs. And finally, number three, the challenge of change. The Conservatives' overarching message in this campaign was that Justin Trudeau was too inexperienced to assume the premiership.
Let's talk about Justin.
I see he's included his picture. Let's start with the experience section. Nothing about balancing a budget or making a payroll.
He has some growing up to do.
I'm not saying no forever, but not now. Justin Trudeau, he's just not ready.
It's a message that had traction initially, but that was ultimately eroded by the promise of change Trudeau set forward. Transforming optimism into a platform for government is no mean feat, however. Trudeau must manage expectations, stick to the principles that resonated so clearly with voters, and solidify his responses to unexpected events, something that has caught him out in the past. Focusing on these three areas will help Justin Trudeau turn the promise of his campaign slogan, "Real change you can believe in," into a government that will serve his supporters and indeed his opponents alike.
Monocle's man in Toronto, Thomas Lewis there, with his guide to the three things the new Canadian PM should focus on. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. Earlier this week, Benjamin Netanyahu made a peculiar speech to the World Zionist Congress, claiming that as late as 1941, Hitler had no urge to murder Europe's Jews, and that he was encouraged to do so by Haji Amin al-Husseini, the Palestinian Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. This is what Andrew Muller discussed with his guests Alessio Patilano and James Rogers on Wednesday's edition of Midori House.
I think if there's one broad conclusion that we can draw from this, I think it's that history continues to affect the Israeli-Palestinian conflict on a day-to-day basis in a way that perhaps it doesn't enter, for example, Western European political discourse. But exactly what point Mr. Netanyahu was trying to make by making this precise allegation, because after all, it's not as if he's made similar allegations against, for example, current Palestinian leaders. He's going back right to the history of the British Mandate. The period about which he's talking, of course, was before the State of Israel even came into being. So quite how what today's politicians has to gain in tactical or strategic terms from this is really unclear.
Well, especially he has already been shouted down, not least by the chief historian at Yad Vashem, who has said he is absolutely flat wrong, in fact. And even more intriguingly by the Chancellor's office in Berlin, who have issued a statement with extraordinary haste emphasising that Germany was itself wholly responsible for the Holocaust. Alessio, the thing that strikes me is that if any other comparable figure in politics in any other Western nation made a statement anywhere near like this, his career would now be over, wouldn't it?
It would, but at the same time, there you are walking a very sort of subtle line, that sort of higher moral ground that comes from victimhood, and we're talking about this terrible tragedy of the Holocaust. So I think that probably Netanyahu's mind created the space for him to make that statement, and mind you, on much a smaller scale, if you take the use of history for political purposes, certainly in sort of Western European context, this is not happening, as James was saying, but if you go to his Asia, history is consistently manipulated on a daily basis. I mean, you know, go to Japan, South Korea, China, whereby history becomes a powerful tool to make a political statement towards a particular target that usually is one of your neighboring countries. So here we're looking at an extreme version of things, one that by the time it's finished being sort of uttered, someone is already saying, hang on, what are you talking about? But it's not an isolated phenomenon, as it were.
I think the curious thing here is the vehemence and volume with which those voices have appeared, not as one would expect from Mr. Netanyahu's opponents or enemies, but from people nominally who are on his side, from other Israeli voices who are extremely critical, as you pointed out. Some very authoritative figures, such as the chief historian at Yad Vashem, and one would clearly imagine that they're clear on who was responsible for the Holocaust. So it does seem a very, very curious intervention.
Monocle's Andrew Muller there with Alessio Patilano from the Department of War Studies at King's College London, and also James Rogers, author of Headlines from the Holy Land. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. Time now for a highlight from Thursday's edition of The Globalist. The Seoul International Aerospace and Defense Exhibition, or simply ADEX, is a showcase for both aviation debuts and some of the latest in defense technology. 380 companies had their wares on display this year at the site near Seoul Airport. Well, to hear the latest goings-on at the expo, Monocle's Georgina Godwin heard from Greg Waldron, Asia Managing Editor for Flight Global.
This is probably one of the biggest defense shows in the Asia-Pacific region. You know, South Korea is still technically at war with North Korea, so you've pretty much got everything on display, but the focus is very much on military aviation. We have a visit by a Royal Air Force, A400M, and that's interesting because, you know, it's Airbus military trying to promote, you know, the concept of strategic airlifters here. You have lots of fighter technology on display, and you also have a great deal of weapons on display as well. It's a real showcase for, you know, armaments to be sold into the South Korean country.
How is Korea trying to build up its aerospace capabilities, both for home use and for export?
Well, Korea is really eager to be independent and indigenous when it comes to its defense capabilities. So they're very keen to build up their own aircraft, their own weapon systems, and this type of thing. But unfortunately, this comes at a very big cost. So they're forced to operate, you know, with U.S. companies on a number of programs to really try to develop that industry. And that can lead to tensions in certain areas, unfortunately, because the West does want to sell stuff and they are willing to transfer technology to a degree. But sometimes the Koreans can come up against walls with exports.
And that's exactly what's happened with the KFX fighter jet.
Yes, that's correct. The KFX is Korea's planned fighter. And this aircraft, if developed, will really catapult Korea into the leading nations of fighter exporters and fighter developers. But the key issue is they want to get export licenses from the United States for these four key technologies, which are basically around radars, sensors, these real crown jewels of the American defense aerospace industry, and the Americans have turned them down. So that's kind of cast a bit of a shadow over the show this year.
Now, just looking around there, at sort of seeing who's on a shopping spree, must be quite a fascinating insight into the geopolitics of the region.
Yeah, these air shows are always very interesting. You can really see what the South Korean government's looking for because they'll speak to the industry participants in private. And then, of course, at the air show, the participants will start displaying various products and really gives an insight into what people are looking for. So a big thing at Seoul would be unmanned helicopters that can go out and look for incursions by North Korean hovercraft. That was one system that was on display here. You have anti-artillery systems, so when somebody shoots an artillery shell, you can either shoot down the artillery shell or you can locate where they are exactly. And it's all about this kind of heavy conventional warfare. That's what the show's real focus is. Whereas on other air shows, the focus tends to be on like the sort of counterinsurgency, guerrilla-type warfare, which is what's been happening in like Afghanistan and Iraq the last 10, 15 years or so.
That was Greg Waldron from Flight Global speaking to Monocle's Georgina Godwin on Thursday's edition of The Globalist. You're with The Recap on Monocle 24. Let's finish today with a discussion on one country's national anthem. Oddly enough, the Spanish one, a military song called the Marcha Real from the 18th century, has no words. Well, one Spanish composer is now looking to change that. Madrid musician Victor Lago has proposed lyrics to the anthem, and he's launched a campaign to collect the 500,000 signatures needed in order to allow lawmakers to debate the issue. So what place does a national anthem hold in the modern world, and does it need words at all? Well, Monocle's Georgina Godwin was joined by journalist and author Alex Marshall on Tuesday's edition of The Globalist.
I don't know, we're kind of marching along to that, aren't we? It's not too bad, is it, Alex?
It's quite jolly, to be honest, I think. It's, you know, personally, I don't, there are many anthems around the world which don't actually have words, and there's many countries which don't even get to the words when they sing it. Argentina, for instance, has this sort of minutes-long, rambunctious, operatic introduction to their song. So when they go to a football ground, they just literally la along because they don't get to the vocals. But, you know, I don't think it necessarily does affect people's attachment to a song. Spain obviously has an awful lot of issues with nationalism, and that's the heart of this story, really.
What do they do then when the national anthem's played? I mean, it must make state events or football matches and things very, very difficult.
It actually makes it quite interesting. Most people stand there in just, you know, sort of solemn contemplation or, you know, respect. Unless you're a Barcelona football fan, you're a Catalan, then you tend to boo it. If you're a Basque separatist, you tend to boo it as well. And that's what the lack of lyrics is a problem. It leads to a sort of vacuum which people can exploit. And you have this in other countries as well. Bosnia's anthem doesn't have lyrics, and you have a similar situation there where people actually sing different songs over the top, creating an utter cacophony. In Kosovo, you have a similar issue. And that's what it more says, the absence of lyrics, that there's a sort of underlying ethnic tension in the country that's a problem that hasn't been dealt with.
How do national anthems usually get their lyrics?
They're traditional songs that sort of come up from the street normally. And the surprising thing about Spain is it started off as just a march for their royal family. It was, you know, written back in the 1760s. And, you know, it just went along as a trumpet flourish they would play when the king walked into the room. When it officially became the national anthem, which is in the mid-1800s, plenty of countries did have anthems. You had God Save the Queen, you had the Marseillaise. And so the surprising thing is the royal family didn't think we pretty much need some lyrics to add to this. And all I can think is that Isabella II, who was a monarch at the time, didn't want any sort of sycophantic singing. She, you know, had enough of that in her royal court, and adding lyrics you'd have to stand through would be going too far.
I mean, as you point out, it's a really tall order writing a song that celebrates a nation which is really quite divided.
Well, it took this man, Victor Largo, it took him, he says, 6 months. And if you read the lyrics, they are incredibly, you know, anodyne. You'd have thought he'd been working on them for about a minute and a half. They are all things sort of like glory to the fatherland. We are going to march forward, singing and breaking down barriers. At one point, it even talks about the country's olive trees. It could literally be an anthem for Greece, for Italy, for dozens of countries. And it's a really hard thing to come up with something original to say about a country that doesn't touch on the many sort of cliches of nationalism is incredibly hard. I mean, I tried myself. I tried to write one for Switzerland. And, you know, I've only spent a few weeks in Switzerland. But to come up with something original to say about that country's mountains and lakes and people is almost impossible.
I'm from Zimbabwe, and we chose the words for our national anthem through a competition. Is that perhaps the way to go, to have a national, maybe an X Factor style?
No, because that's what, when I said earlier that I wrote these words for Switzerland, that's because they've been having this contest to write words themselves to modernise their anthem and have the world's first anthem fit for the 21st century. And it leads to entries from amateurs, from people writing books and journalists. And that isn't the best way to go an anthem. To get, you need basically a moment of national inspiration. You largely need a crisis or a moment of triumph, and that will inspire people to actually come up with something good. So, you know, the Marseillaise isn't written in the French Revolution. God Save the Queen was written during an invasion of England. You need a moment like that, something critical to inspire. And, you know, Zimbabwe's lyrics aren't the greatest, and, you know, neither are most which come about through competitions. That's just, but that is the modern way. You have to have a democratic vote to pick something so important, so people tend to go down that route.
And I'm guessing that you're not holding out much hope for Mr. Largo and his Spanish lyrics.
Well, he's only so far got 500 votes, so given he needs another 500,000 to go, I don't think he's got much of a chance.
Alex Marshall there, whose recent book, Republic or Death, looks at the history of national anthems around the world. He was speaking to Monocle's Georgina Godwin on Tuesday's edition of The Globalist. And that's all we've got time for on this week's edition of The Recap. This show was produced by Marcus Hippie and edited by Weidong Lin. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programs right here on Monocle 24. But for now, I'm Daniel Giacopelli. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.